Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Well, in spite of everything, the ship is once again in safe harbor.
Well, we always managed to muddle through, sir.
You know, 4 days ago, I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but I'm going to miss you, sir.
You think you'll never see me again, don't you?
Well, I'd hate to never see you again.
That's nice. In that case, I have some information that should make you very happy. I have been given permanent command of this ship.
Command of the princess?
Forever. Until I retire or you sink it, whichever comes first.
Well, I guess congratulations are in order, sir.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you.
For me, too. On your new job and on getting command of a terrific ship and a terrific crew.
Well, I think you're pretty good.
In spite of my reputation, you will find that I am the easiest man in the world to work for. All I demand is perfection.
Well, what time does the mutiny begin?
You would. We would.
All right, it's Dave Player here on 720 WGN. So this month marks 40 years since the Love Boat set sail on television. Viewers tuned in every week to see the comedic romance between the crew of a cruise ship, the Pacific Princess and its passengers, starring some of Hollywood's biggest stars of the day, all looking for something exciting and new. The show starred Bernie Coppell, Ted Lang, Lauren Tweez, Fred Grandy, Jill Whelan, and of course, the captain of the ship, Gavin McLeod, who wrote a book a few years back about his life on and off the air called This Is Your Captain Speaking. And Gavin joins us tonight. Please welcome Gavin McLeod, everybody. Hey, Gavin.
Hi, Dave. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here. I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about, the very beginnings, over 50 years in show business. How did you get the acting bug?
Well, I really got it when I was 4 years old. I was in the kindergarten, and it was a Mother's Day play, and I was a little boy. I had the lead. I had beautiful blonde curly hair.
Me too.
And the whole story was I wanted to get something for my mother for Mother's Day. And so I went through the forest, and there were all my classmates in cardboard costumes, a sheep and all different animals. And I finally got the biggest guy in the class, and he was a bear. And he said, the thing to give your mother is a bear hug. Well, I went traipsing back, telling all the other animals that's what I was going to do. And I finally did. I gave her a bear hug. That was it. And people applauded.
And you probably
and when they applauded, I had never heard a sound like that in my life. I said, wow, they like me.
They really, really like
more
me.
Of this. And that's how I decided at a little tender age of 4 years old. I'm 82 now. I should be a lot better. I've been acting all these years.
Yeah, right.
but that's how it all started, Dave.
Wow. Well, it was years later, obviously. Did you do some acting in high school as well?
Oh, yeah. I won an acting award 3 years in a row. And then I got a scholarship, a drama scholarship to Ithaca College upstate New York. And I got a BFA in drama. And then I went to New York City to try to make it in the big time and the Big Apple, and got a job at Radio City Music Hall, $34 a week as an usher, and they liked me so much they promoted me to elevator operator, made $37 a week. And I would make the rounds of agents, and none of the agents were interested in me because I was a bald-headed kid. It's a very strange look for a young person. Maybe not today, but back then it yeah. was really strange. And they said, there's no work for you. Why? What? And so I knew I had to get a hairpiece. So I saved my money, and my roommate who was doing the lights at Radio City Music Hall, who was a former friend of mine at college, he left in the second year, never graduated, was making $600 a week. I spent 4 years, I graduated, was making $37 a week. So you can see, I thought it was like a little inequity there.
Yeah, a little
bit. So anyway, he loaned me another 100, I had 25, and I went down to get a hairpiece. And there's a big story in the book about that, because it really changed my life. I got a hairpiece they'll have to read the story because it's a long story, but I got a hair piece that belonged to somebody else. He had just gotten a new one that day.
I read that. Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, and so as a result, I got my first Broadway show because of that hair piece, and then a Rockette got turned on with a Rockette and eventually married a Rockette with that hairpiece.
See, look at that. Look at how that worked out for you. See, I'm completely, Gavin, I'm completely bald as well. And I got to tell you, the lights and so forth, they're not complimentary toward, the skin, as you well know.
Well, I know. There's something else, too. As I grew older, I had a cancer on my head. So I have really two holes in my head where they cut those things yeah. out. So whenever a light hits them, you can really see
sure.
it becomes concave. These things. And I was with Ed Asner. I hadn't seen him for a long time. We were shooting something. He says, man, you got a hole in your head. I said, Ed, I've had a hole in my head for years. You're just finally noticing.
I had the opportunity about 6 months ago. I'm on the board for the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, and Ed was up here with Marion Ross filming a pilot for a sitcom. And I know you're friends with Marion as well, but I got to tell you, I've learned very quickly that Ed says whatever's on his mind.
He does, yeah. He's old enough to do that now.
Right, no filters. No filters. You know, so let's go back a little bit, because your first movie role was in the late 50s. It was called I Want to Live. Tell me a little bit about that experience in your first.
Well, that was with Susan Hayward, and Robert Wise was the director. I had tested for him for Run Silent, Run Deep. And that was a Clark Gable movie in a submarine. And he liked me. And he did the test with me, Robert Wise. And he said, you know, I really like you, kid. He said, but I've got one bald-headed guy in this already. And I don't think I should really have two
it's really prejudice.
In the same boat.
Really prejudice.
And the
Gavin.
Other one was Don Rickles.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, way back then. But
yeah.
Eventually he was doing I Want to Live, and I went to see him with my hair on, and because the casting guy, Lynn Stallmaster, thought I should play opposite, as a drug addict, because that's what I had just done in the plays, and I sort of had that reputation for playing those kinds of guys. And so Bob, and my reading was just, he thought I should get it, but she thought I was too young with him with the hair on, and Walter Wanger thought I was too young with the hair on. So I took the hair off, and I did a job that lasted for about 2 days. But one of the things, I was a plainclothes, if you ever see I Want to Live, which got an Oscar, but also at the last billing, it says Lieutenant. I didn't even have a proper name. Lieutenant Gavin McLeod.
Ooh, very
that
nice.
Was my first billing in a big movie. I was thrilled. So what happens, I had to do an interrogation scene with Susan Hayward. And a friend of mine, who never worked very much, but knew had all the answers, you know, why is it always that way? And he said, look, I hear she's a B-I-T-C-H. You better be careful. You're going to pull her hair, man. I wouldn't want to be in your shoes. So I approached doing that scene with great timidity. And
yeah.
I pulled her hair.
Oh, really?
I was interrogating her.
Uh-huh.
And we did it again. He spent a whole day on that scene. I did it again, and she called me over. She said, Gavin, there's a rumor I could get an Oscar for this. It would really help me if you would really yank my hair.
Oh, really?
I said,
okay.
I don't want to hurt you. You know, I mean, gee whiz, look who you are. She said, no, you'll help me. So we went. I yanked that hair. I can't tell you how hard I yanked it. Print.
Really?
6 months later, the Oscars are on. The best actress, Susan Hayward, for I Want to Live. I told my wife, I helped to get that
you
Oscar.
You did. You absolutely
I helped
did. That's fantastic. I love that.
And that was Robert Wise. And I just, he always had impressed me as being a great leader. And then eventually, many years later, he called me and he said, how tall are you? I said, how tall do you want me to be?
If you can
and
do
he said, well, I'm doing a movie with Steve McQueen, and you can't be taller. I said, Steve and I played brothers on Broadway. He's about an inch and a half taller than I am. He says, okay, you got a 10-month job, kid.
you're hired.
And that's when we did the Sand Pebbles, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then you did Operation Petticoat with Cary Grant and Tony Curtis.
Oh, that was in the beginning. Yeah, that's after I met Blake Edwards. Before you know it, he had me in Operation Petticoat, and it's amazing. I just went to do the Today Show in New York, and as I was going in, there was a man standing there. I guess he was a guard or something. He says, "My favorite picture you ever did was Operation Petticoat."
That's awesome.
I was signing books down in Nashville, and a guy said to me, he said, "You know," he said, "every Christmas we got our Operation Petticoat out and look at it." You know, it's just one of those films that was wonderful. And then with Blake, I did, after that, I did, first I did the Peter Gunn pilot, and I played an Ivy League heavy there that had never been seen on television before. And then I did Operation Petticoat, and then I did High Time with Bing Crosby, written by Garson Kanin. And then I did The Party with Peter Sellers, which is quite a cult film.
Yeah,
then we did Mr. Lucky's.
You did a ton of movies, and then you started dipping your toe in television. You did a variety of TV shows over the years.
Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of them.
Yeah, Twilight Zone, Andy Griffith, Hogan's Heroes, The Untouchables, Get Smart, Hawaii Five-O, and you got your first regular TV role in McHale's Navy in 62, and that was Seaman Joseph Happy Haynes, right?
Yes, right, yeah.
So how did you get that role?
Well, I had just done a play in New York. We went across country with this wonderful play called The Captains and the Kings. And Dana Andrews, Lee Grant, Peter Graves' first big play, and a bunch of great character men, Joe Campanella. And Paul Gregory produced it for the Theater Guild, and he said, "I want you to know," he said, "we're sold out for 4 weeks, so we're going to get a great run out of this play, so bring your family." I had two little boys then. David was my second boy. I love the name David Dave. It means beloved. And you sound like you are, and I know he is.
Very nice of you.
Anyway, so I bring their little kids to New York. My wife comes, and we play for 8 days. I had my first house going up for $24,650. So I come back to the West Coast, and I do it Untouchables. I do a Brinks Robbery special. But then what else? I have to move. My last dollar is going
to
be going into the house. I decided to go into the house. So here I am. The first month's rent's paid. I don't know where the rest is coming from. And I get a call from Universal. They're doing a series called McHale's Navy. And sounded great. Ernie Borgnine, are you kidding? Wow.
Yeah, right.
Academy Award actor. And so I saw them, and they offered me a job of 42 weeks out of the year. That's pretty cool.
That's a pretty good deal.
And I felt I could rest with the house and the responsibility, you know. And then he had another little baby coming. And so...
Well, that steady work, too, so that you didn't have to travel a lot either when you were filming
all these
movies.
No, well, at that time the freeway wasn't there. So it was a long haul for me to get to work.
I bet.
But now there's a freeway. You can do it in no time. But I didn't think anything about the size. I mean, I just thought about, okay, the employment is great. But I had like one or two lines a week at the most. And Ted Knight, my buddy, came in. This is all in the book. He was my oldest friend in California since 1957. He came on as a guest star. This is years before the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Right, early 60s.
And he said, "Gab, you got to have lunch." So we had lunch, and he said, "I got to talk to you." He says, "I don't know how you're doing it." He said, "Gavin, you had a career going. You're a glorified extra." I said, "I know." I said, "I know he's having the director has me stand up there to hide the new buildings they're building at Universal. I know I'm feeling lousy, Ted." So I really started to think about what he said, glorified extra, after all those years. And
that motivate you?
Eat me up.
Yeah.
I started to drink to try to get away from the pain of it all. And that was the beginning of a whole transition in my life.
And that's something that, you know, how did you deal with that throughout? Because it happened to you, and in reading the book, it happened to you on and off, you know, throughout the next 10, 15 years. That's kind of how you dealt with those situations. Was there ever issues going to work that way, or was it always really behind the scenes going home?
Oh, no, it was always, you know, but the thing is, after work, you'd go across the street at Universal. They had a bar there. And I wasn't the only one. Some of the other guys on the show were with me, you know?
Sure.
But that was not my style up to that point, except even my grandfathers and father. They didn't have drugs. They had alcohol, you know?
Yeah.
And so I ran to all that, and then, as the book indicates, I felt my worth. I felt worthless. And so I really was drinking a lot one night. I left Tom Skerritt's house. We had done a movie together. And I was just going to end it. So I went up to Mulholland Drive. It's a peak of these hills up here. And I said, that's it, man. You know, I'm not worth anything. And who's going to miss me? And I started to go off Mulholland Drive. And something took my right leg and put it on the brake. It wasn't me. I was, like, out of it. And I eventually recovered from that. And I went to Robert Blake's house because he lived very close to that. Jack Nicholson was up there and Marlon Brando, but Robert lived up there, and Robert and I had done plays together. And so he said, what are you doing up in the middle of the night? I said, oh, man, it's not worth it. I'm just nothing. He said, cut this out. He said, you need to see a shrink. And I said, I'm going to try to get you in where I go. And so eventually he did, and I went to him, and in about a month's time, he said, you know what you have to do? I said, no, I have to get out of that show. And so I did. I went to Eddie Montaigne, the producer, and he was so understanding. I said, you don't know what, Eddie, you can save me and my family. You got to just let me fly again. I'll land someplace. He said, I had no idea. I said, no. And so that next day, I got a call from my friend John Herman, who was directing my favorite Martians. He said, you want to put your hair on and a blue plaid suit and come work for me? I said, you bet. So I did three My Favorite Martians, playing Barbara Britton's nephew, fast-talking salesman. And that's when Robert Wise called me. As soon as that was over, Robert Wise called me to go to China. I did that whole thing with Steve for over 10 months. I came back, and then I got a call to do a new series called The Rat Patrol in Spain. So I went to Spain. So my career was starting all over again. And
traveling
all over the world,
But not only that, but it motivated, it ended up being, as much as it brought you down, it ended up being somewhat of a motivator.
Exactly.
To do something better and better with yourself.
I've often wondered, Dave, if Ted hadn't come on the show and described what I was doing as that glorified extra, I wonder what would have happened. Well, I don't have to wonder because it didn't.
Right, but he did it probably, though, as a friend, to just try to light a fire under you and say, hey,
yeah,
you're better
really
than this.
Did.
You're better
than this. I don't think he ever thought I was going to quit, but...
Yeah.
Because years later, we talked about that, and, he was one of my closest friends in the whole world. And
right.
He was a big brother to me. He was 7 years older, and I really miss that guy.
Yeah, I bet you do. I bet you do. Well, I'll tell you what, it was nothing but up from this point with the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the Love Boat, and we'll talk about that and so much more with Gavin McLeod next on 720 WGN.
Exciting and new.
State Player on 720 WGN, and we're talking to Gavin McLeod on the 40th anniversary of 70s pop culture favorite, The Love Boat. We were talking a little bit, Gavin, about life and really a wake-up call for you that your friend Ted Knight gave you and really gave you some a better outlook and some energy to go out there and do something more and he told you that you were really better than what you were doing, and you got out there and you started to get some great roles. And one of the roles that I remember, because I'm a big fan of the show, and it's great when you discover people that are familiar in other television roles or other movie roles in their earlier work. And I always found it so much fun when I saw you on the Dick Van Dyke Show. It's a classic episode.
Empress Carlotta's necklace.
Yeah, it was Mary's. It was Laura Petrie's necklace that she had.
Dick bought for her.
Yeah.
This guy, Richard Deacon's cousin, comes in, and I swear I only got the part because I had a bald head like
him. You look like him, exactly.
It was a fast-talking jewelry salesman. We had them on all the sets. They would come on all of our sets. Some of them were women. Always selling jewelry. Well, that's what this guy did.
Really?
And he conned Dick into buying everything. It was $37.50 or something,
yeah, right,
Dave, wasn't
right.
it?
Yep. You were chewing a lot
no
of gum.
Whatever you wanted, it was $37. I don't know. That was so many years ago.
You were chewing gum like you were a shyster. You know, I remember that. You were chewing it big and wide. I remember that.
It was a lot of fun. And he buys this ugly-looking thing for Laura, Mary. I think it was an anniversary, a birthday or something, yeah. And he said it belonged to Empress Carlotta. It was her necklace. Well, he thought that would be a great deal. Empress Carlotta's necklace for $37.50.
Exactly. And she didn't quite know how to tell him that it wasn't fabulous.
Oh, Mary was so wonderful in everything she's ever done. Oh, my heavens.
But I love that along your career. I mean, you know, and that's what a lot is in this book is your experiences working with all these Hollywood stars. But a lot of them were the people that you ended up with. Obviously, on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, you had those experiences with Ted and Mary and others early on. How did you land the iconic role of Murray Slaughter on the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Well, I had just come home. I was in the Yugoslavia doing Kelly's Heroes, which is a very popular film with a lot of guys.
So Don Rickles again and Telly Savalas.
Well, I played with Donald Sutherland basically in the tanks. So I just returned from that wonderful run. And we were rehearsing Carousel. I was doing Jigger in Carousel. And my agent calls and said, Mary Tyler Moore is doing a pilot, and they want to see you. I said, oh, great. I love her. And he said, so I'll have them send you the scripts. I said, terrific, Alex. So they sent me two scripts, the pilot and then Rhoda's Mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I read them both, and they really knocked me out. I said, this writing is something else. And then it had on the cover of the first page, Gavin, the part of Lou Grant.
Right.
And so I started reading it with Lou Grant in mind, and no, I wouldn't believe myself in that. No, I don't.
You knew it.
I wouldn't believe myself. Nobody else would.
Yeah.
I wouldn't believe myself as Ted Baxter. But this little guy, Murray, you know, I think maybe I can do something with him, even though he's not the biggest part. He's the third guy. That didn't bother me. I just thought I could really do something with this character. And so I went in to see the producers, Ethel Winant, the first female vice president of a big network. And she really fought to get that show on, by the way. And I did all the Lou Grant readings, and we had a wonderful time. And I had my hand on the door, and I said, you know, you guys, I really like the part of Murray Slaughter. You do? Because I was doing guest star big roles, and they didn't think about me for that. I said, yeah, I think I – and Jim said, can you read? I said, sure, let's read. So I read for it, and I got some laughs, and I said, well, good luck with the show, you know. And then I went out, and I ran into Ed Asner. He was pacing back and forth. I went to rehearsal, and about 3 hours later, my agent comes over, and he waves to me, and so we had a break. I said, what's up, Alex? And he said, they want you to do the Mary Tyler Moore pilot. I said, oh, wow, is that fabulous? What part? He said, I don't know. Is there a guy named Murray in that?
Oh, that's
great. I said, there sure is, and that was the beginning of that.
Wow. And did you, first of all, you keep running into all these bald guys, obviously, that you're doing business with throughout the years between Rickles and everybody. How did Ted get on the show now? Was that a recommendation
Ted
by yourself?
Ted was the last one cast.
Yeah.
Ted Baxter was supposed to be a young guy.
Okay.
And they saw all these handsome young guys. Like, there was a series called He and She years ago. Jay Sandwich directed that. And Jack Cassidy was in that. And he played an egocentric kind of guy. And so they wanted the same thing with Ted Baxter. And they had seen all these young guys. A lot of them came back and did our show in different roles. But then Ted came in. He was the oldest of them all. And he read, and they had him come back. And he said the second time he went back, he saw this blue blazer. And he said he went and bought this blue blazer, wore this blue blazer into the reading, and he got the job.
Wow, and the rest is history.
He was the last one cast. He was absolutely, you know, he was so brilliant in that role.
Well, what I mean, but with everybody you worked with Mary and even throw in Betty White, I mean, what an incredible experience. That,
and Valerie.
That, absolutely.
And Georgia.
Yeah, yeah, and Cloris.
And Cloris,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know at the time, I mean, at any point during this show, you know, how important the show would become in the history of television?
I don't think so. I don't think anybody did. We were just happy to get on the air. I remember we shot the pilot, and then CBS wanted us to redo some things. They were concerned about, in their conservatism, about Rhoda and being Jewish. And we couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
And they had to make certain changes. Then we shot it again during the middle of the next week. And then we always worked around this big table like they did on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And days after that, the phone rings and Mary goes, and it turns out to be Bob Wood, the head of CBS. And she's talking and talking and talking. She hangs up and she turns around to all of us sitting there around the table with our scripts. She said, "Well, kids, you can send out the laundry. They picked us up for a year." And that's how we heard that we were picked up.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, that theme song says, "Love is all around." It really was.
Okay, Gavin, for most of your career in the movies and in television, you spent a lot of time, you know, either in the military or on the ocean, or both, you know, with Operation Petticoat and McHale's Navy and Ensign Pulver and the Sand Pebbles, the Rat Patrol, Hogan's Heroes, Kelly's Heroes. You were finally promoted to captain on the Love Boat in 1977. So the Love Boat was on the air for 10 seasons. You've got to have so many memories to even mention. You had hundreds of guest stars, big names in Hollywood. Share some of your favorite memories about that show.
Well, you know, we actually were on nine years and 2 weeks.
Okay, is that what it was?
And there were so many guest stars. You know, if this book really sells, I said, we've got to do another one with all the stories about some of the other stars, and we'll call it This Is Your Captain Still Speaking.
Well, I mean, there's so many of them.
But it's true. I had to be so selective on who I was going to write about, because after I finished, I would wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh, why didn't I put that in the book? Why didn't I put, there were so many different stories. But no, the Love Boat, the reason I was so proud and everything of the Love Boat is was like Murray got a promotion. Because all of Murray's fans really, like Aaron, when they first saw the pilot, Aaron said they pushed those buttons, they went crazy when they saw you come on as the captain.
That's cool.
And that was fabulous. And that's so that fun. That worked very well for me. And so all the critics hated it. They called us mindless television, sick like the Titanic, and all these things. But eventually we were in 90 countries. We all became goodwill ambassadors for the United States. And we gave birth to a new cruise industry, really a new cruise industry.
You really did.
And I've been working for Princess Cruises ever since 86, ever since the show went off the air.
That's a big change, though, from going, you know, when the show that you were on previously with Mary Tyler Moore was so focused on the central cast. And then, you know, you were kind of the ringmaster, not only for the, you know, Ted Lang and everybody else who was on the show, but then you also had the opportunity to work with, I mean, just hundreds and hundreds
Dave. You sound enthusiastic as I am.
It was fun watching.
It was what a gift it was. You know, when I grew up, for instance, 1 week we had on Joan Fontaine, and she was great with Richard Basehart. She did Rebecca and all these things. Well, it was reputed that she and her sister Olivia de Havilland hadn't spoken to each other in 7 or 8 years, even more. And so 2 weeks later, we get Olivia de Havilland to come in. They bring her over from France.
How great is that?
And we're playing with her. And Olivia de Havilland, my grandmother, took me to see her in a movie called To Each His Own, years and years and years ago. And here I am holding this incredible actress in my arms, thinking if my grandmother could see me now. And I tell you, it wasn't a week went by that I didn't hold. I'd held Mary Martin in my arms. I fell in love with her when I was 16 when I saw her in South Pacific in New York. I'm holding her in my arms. I said, can I tell you something? She said, yeah. I said, I've been in love with you since I was 16 years old.
That's awesome.
And you get to tell Nellie Furbush. Oh, she was so incandescent on the stage. And then there was Ethel Merman. And I met Ethel when she and Ernie got engaged.
Wow.
Way before Mikhail's Navy time. And then she, and this is one of my favorite shows. We did the Love Boat Follies with Ethel Merman, Carol Channing, Ann Miller, Della Reese,
wow,
Cab Calloway, and Van Johnson.
Oh, man.
I was in actor's heaven.
Oh, yeah, it was Hollywood's greats. Oh, my
gosh. The only thing is that critic from the L.A. Times still hated us, and he reviewed that show. He knocked them, and I said, I can't believe this guy. And then he finished the entire review by saying, and then when Gavin McLeod is the captain, finished his number, they should have torpedoed the ship.
Oh, man. Merciless. Merciless. But I got to tell you, Gavin, that was appointment viewing at that time. I just remember, you know, when I was a kid, and I was a kid when it was on, I was like 10 or 12 years old. But, you know, you had to have your teeth brushed, your pajamas on. You had to, you know, take your bath, take your shower, whatever it was. And you were in front of that TV. Mom was making popcorn at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
You had to be sitting in front of that TV for the Love Boat.
Oh, wow. It was so wonderful to be a part of that, you know. You get jobs and you get jobs as an actor. But that was really, really very, very special. And we just had a reunion on the talk show the other day at CBS out here. And we hadn't seen each other for some years, and it was so nice to be able to hug each other and just love on each other, you know?
Yeah, you can catch that on YouTube if you want to see that. Now, didn't your wife Patty do an episode of The Love Boat?
She did six of them.
Oh, really?
I'll tell you what happened was, Lauren Tweez, who played Julie McCoy, was getting married in real life. And so we went to the wedding, and we sat in back of Aaron Spelling and Candy. And he turned around and he said, Patty, I've got a great part for you next week. Well, we were floored because I hadn't pushed for anything like that.
Sure.
And I think it was the second season, the first season. And she was playing opposite Jim Backus. I mean, Jim Backus,
right,
that played James Dean's father in, you know, that great movie that he did.
I get
the name.
And
Rebel
was
Without a Cause.
Sure.
And then he did Gilligan's Island, and he was the voice of Mr. Magoo, and Jim Backus was a pro's pro.
Yeah.
Patty held her own.
That's
she
great.
Really held her own. She was wonderful, and then she did five more. She was in Australia with me. There's a picture of her playing a character with a big red wig on and the captain in the book. Yes, and so that was a blessing, too. Yeah.
Well, and you said earlier, you know, life wasn't always perfect, and whose is, by the way? You know,
yeah.
you lost your dad when you were at the young age of 13. You mentioned that you struggled, you know, with alcoholism, and that's kind of how you did some of your own therapy through that, and it affected your marriage. And and you and Patty, you got divorced, but then you got remarried, and there's a reconciliation, obviously, that took place. What kind of brought that all together, and what happened there?
Well, what happened was God works in mysterious ways. In that three-year period, she didn't want the divorce. I did. I really put my work before her. Because when my part wasn't big, I was traveling all over the country doing press. And this was something, the culmination of a lot of years' work, having that responsibility.
Sure.
Welcoming people on this show that hadn't worked in 25, 30 years, you know, making them feel good. I was standing with a lot of the different things besides just learning the lines. And I put that before her or anybody else. And I just felt I couldn't handle both. So we got a divorce. And in that three-year period, she didn't want the divorce. And she went to psychiatrists on both coasts because we always had a place in Manhattan. And they all said, you know, the guy doesn't want to be married, so you have to let him go. She says, I don't want to let him go. He's my husband. And so finally, after that period of almost 3 years, she runs into Pat Boone and Shirley. And they talk her about God, about what God can do for you if you turn your life over. And so she eventually became a born-again Christian, which means she recognizes Jesus as the Son of God. And so something happened. My mother developed a cyst the size of a baseball inside her left brain, and they were going to operate. And they couldn't tell us if she was going to live or be a vegetable or what, because she was in her mid-70s. And the morning of that operation, I'm living in Beverly Hills thinking the bigger the house, the happier you're going to be. I was all alone, kind of a sad scene.
Yeah.
But what happened, I woke up at 7 o'clock, and I started to pray to Jesus. And I said, if you give my mom more time in this life, I'll turn my life over to you. I don't care if I act. My mother had been a widow since she was 39 years old and never got married. And here she is in her mid-70s. I mean, I bought a condo for her and things like that, but it's not the same. So that's what I did. I just prayed to Jesus. And as soon as I said that, something told me to call Julie, my secretary, so I could get Patty's number to call her. I don't know why I'm doing this, but something's guiding me. I got the number. Julie said, you sure you want to do this, boss? I said, oh, yeah, I sure do. I don't know why, but I want to talk to her. So I called her at 7:15, and she said, hello. I said, hi, this is Gavin. She says, I was just thinking about you. I said, can we be friends? And she said, that's all I've ever wanted.
Wow.
I don't know why I'm even saying this. And then I said, can I see you? She said, well, that would be wonderful, except I have to go away. I'm on the road. I belong to a group called Ladies, L-A-D-I-E-S. I said, what does that stand for? And she says, life after divorce can eventually be sane. It's full of all of us who have been dumped by you guys.
Yeah.
I said, oh. I said, so when can I see you? And she said, what about Monday? So the following Monday, I went down there, and I knocked, and there was no answer. I knocked again. There was no answer. I said, uh-oh. She's standing me up. I don't blame her. I was a rat. I tried it one more time, and then the door opens. She's there, 5 foot tall. We hug and hug and hug. And she says, I'm sorry, Gavin, your dinner's cold. It's been waiting for 3 years.
Oh, what a great line.
And then she goes in, and she says, I have this for you. And she brought out a Bible with my name on it. She said, look, I put on my ring again. And I have set a place for you, waiting for you to come home. And every time I come in here, I say, hi, honey, I'm home. And we just talked and talked. She explained to me what born again meant. I said, that's what I want. She put on television and I could see some evangelists there. I said, Patty, that's what I want. That's exactly what I want. And so before you know it, Pat and Shirley Boone and Patty brought me to church on the way. A wonderful church in the San Fernando Valley, Pastor Jack Hayford. And I gave my life to Christ. We got baptized in the water. And my life hasn't been the same since.
Gavin, thanks so much for spending some time with us tonight.
David, this has been a very special interview. And that's because you're a very special guy, and you really live up to your name, which means beloved.
Well, thank you, Gavin, for saying that. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN.